From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, when Guantanamo Bay prosecutor Stuart Couch stumbled upon a detainee being tortured, he asked a fellow lawyer, "Did you see that?"
And he said, "Yeah, that's approved." When I heard that, that was sort of code word to me that this was something that was being policy-driven.
That's our cover story, Guantanamo Bay, and the tough question it asks about our values. Do we sacrifice justice for security? And a look at our increasingly multiracial nation, including what it means for parents.
It never occurred to me that my motherhood would be questioned because I didn't look like my daughter.
Writer James Salter has a new novel. It's been 34 years since his last. I had a great conversation with him about his legacy and culture and the Kardashians, and a man's effort to get movie theaters to provide closed caption glasses to their deaf audience members, like his son.
The fact that I can take my son to a movie is literally bringing tears to my eyes.
Plus, the man who so fascinated his American audience that he received 1 million letters in 1929 alone, Robert, believe it or not, Ripley. And my backstage conversation with a hip-hop, country, metal, and soul-infused saxophonist, Rudresh Mahanthappa. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. The crisis in Guantanamo keeps growing in size and intensity. According to the military's own count, 100 of the 166 men held in the prison there are now on hunger strike, and the 27 most in danger of dying are being force-fed. Last month, guards had to forcibly subdue a camp where even the most cooperative detainees are held. The hunger strike was triggered on February 6 by a search of inmates' Qurans. The details are hotly disputed, but what's remarkable is that everyone, detainees, lawyers, the military, they all agree about the real reason for the unrest.
The issue is frustration, that this thing has just gone on too long.
That's the Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg, who's been reporting on Guantanamo since the 90s.
Remember, the president said more than 4 years ago he was going to close it down. Flash forward to February 6th, it was the spark that lit the anger and the frustration that nothing had changed, that 86 of them, 86 of the 166 men were cleared for release, and nobody seemed to be leaving.
That's our cover story today. Is the prison in Guantanamo here to stay?
It is not a surprise to me that we've got problems in Guantanamo.
If the hunger strike is intended to draw attention, it's working brilliantly. After months of silence on the issue, President Obama renewed his years-old pledge, speaking at a recent press conference.
When I was elected in 2008, I said we need to close Guantanamo. I continue to believe that we've got to close Guantanamo.
But there hasn't been any will in Congress to do that. Republican or Democrat, no one wants detainees kept in their state. And polls show a majority of Americans do not want the prison in Guantanamo to close. Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch was assigned as a prosecutor in Guantanamo Bay in 2002, and for him, it was also personal. Prior to becoming a lawyer, he'd been a pilot in the Marine Corps. He then went to a law school. His friend Michael Horrocks got a job with United Airlines.
So after 9/11, the word went around our very small community that Mike had been the co-pilot for United 175, which was the second airplane to hit the World Trade Center.
Colonel Couch is a self-described conservative Republican and devout Christian. His feelings about the mission began to change upon his first trip to Guantanamo in 2003, when he stumbled upon a disturbing scene. He described to me what he saw.
At the end of the hallway, I heard this really heavy metal rock music coming from one of the interview rooms. So I walked down the hallway to get him to turn it down. When I looked into the door, it was ajar. The room was blacked out with the exception of a strobe light in the end of the room, and the music was just deafening. At the end of the room, I could see a detainee wearing the orange jumpsuit, and he was shackled hand to foot, seated on the floor, and he was rocking back and forth. I could see his lips moving, which I interpreted that he was praying. There were these two civilian men there, and I asked them, you know, what was going on, and they basically told me to move along, and they shut the door in my face. And when I saw that scene is the first inkling that I had that there was a problem with what was going on at Guantanamo.
And how long was it before you got a sense that maybe this was not an aberration, not an isolated incident?
Well, there was a Air Force captain, a lawyer, who was accompanying me at that moment. And I turned to him and I said, did you see that? And he said, yeah, that's approved. When I heard that, that was sort of code word to me that this was something that was being policy driven.
How did this affect what you're trying to do in terms of doing your job?
Well, the concern I had as a prosecutor was the circumstances upon which those statements were taken was going to be essential. So when I saw what I saw, the light in my head went off that we might have problems with the evidence that we have against these detainees. Ultimately, I had reservations from a moral perspective as a Christian.
I want to talk about that. Can you explain how that detainee abuse offended your sense of Christian morality?
Well, one of the basic tenets of the Christian faith is the notion of the inherent dignity of every human being. That is derived from the Christian belief that God created man in his own image. And as I see it, the torture of another human being, it comes from the same bolt of cloth.
Now, you took your concerns, you know, you wrote memos, let your supervisors know that there were some real legal problems with this evidence and with these cases. What happened?
Well, there was one specific case where I raised all of these concerns. The detainee.
Was this Mohamedou Slahi?
This was Mohamedou Ould Slahi. He was subjected to the enhanced interrogation techniques that I subsequently found out had been approved up to the level of the Secretary of Defense. What I found out later of his interrogations, they included sensory deprivation. It was insinuated that he would be killed. There was one incident where a mock execution was being carried out. Knowing the information I did, I had an ethical obligation to provide the information that I knew to any defense attorney that would represent Slahi in the future so that he could avail himself of the protections of the UN Torture Convention. Ultimately, for me, though, from a moral perspective as a Christian, I just felt like what had been done to this man was reprehensible, and for that reason, I would have nothing else to do with this prosecution.
Lieutenant Colonel Couch abandoned that case in May of 2004. Mohamedou Slahi still has not had his day in court. The Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg feels that the Guantanamo prison represents a significant shift in American values.
Before September 11th, I never imagined that we would be talking about holding people forever who we couldn't charge, for whom there was either insufficient evidence to bring them to trial, or for whom the evidence was so tainted that we couldn't bring them to trial.
So how do we balance justice with security? Alberto Gonzalez was in President Bush's inner circle in the critical days after 9/11. I asked him if, in a rush to extract secrets from the enemy, did we jeopardize our ability to convict these men for their crimes?
I think that President Bush understood that some of the measures that we took in order to gather up information, in order to keep America safe, might make it more difficult to prosecute individuals in the future. But as far as he was concerned, that was the balance that we were going to strike in order to make sure that not another human life here in America would be at jeopardy.
Gonzalez served as White House counsel at the time of the 9/11 attacks, and he succeeded John Ashcroft as U.S. Attorney General in 2005. Gonzalez still believes, as he did in 2001, that the prisons in Guantanamo serve an essential purpose and that there is no immediate need to shut them down.
I fundamentally disagree with President Obama on this. I think that if you go visit the facility at Guantanamo, and I visited the facility three times when I was White House counsel, I'd have to say that today I suspect the facility, quite frankly, is much better in terms of the protections, the amenities given to the detainees there, than what you might find in some state and local facilities here in this country. When President Obama says that what we're doing there is inconsistent with our values, I don't understand what he's referring to when he makes that kind of statement.
You said that both President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld very much wanted to see the prison at Guantanamo closed. If it made sense as an institution and is consistent with our values, why the desire to get rid of it?
Well, of course, because as has been widely reported, there were negative repercussions from Guantanamo. A lot of publicity, some of it accurate, much of it inaccurate in terms of conditions and mistreatment at Guantanamo. We know that it was used as a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. We always envisioned that it would not be a long-term solution to the issue of detention. And we hope that we could find a solution at some point so that we could close Guantanamo as quickly as possible.
Earlier, I spoke with a former military commissions prosecutor, Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch. He considers this very, very deeply and morally. He's said that he's worried that American values, in a sense, might have changed over the last 10 years. What would you say to Colonel Couch?
What I'd say to Colonel Couch is that, again, I fail to understand when someone says it's inconsistent with our values. It's totally consistent with international law. It's totally consistent with our Constitution. It's totally consistent with our tradition and our practice when you look back at the history of conflicts that the United States has been in. And so people still may not like it. It bothers them that we can detain someone indefinitely without charges. They may not like it. That's one thing. We can have a debate about that. But if the question is whether or not what we're doing there is lawful or constitutional, then I don't think that that can be debated, quite frankly. It is lawful, and I hope this administration is more successful than the Bush administration was in finding an alternative solution. And President Bush charged us with trying to find an alternative. We were not able to do so. I'm sure President Obama has charged his administration to find a solution that would be acceptable not only to the Congress, but also to the will of the American people.
Former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Even if President Obama succeeds in closing the Guantanamo prison, he's been less clear about addressing the root cause of the current crisis there, the hopelessness of the inmates' indefinite detention. The Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg thinks that we'll have the prison in Guantanamo, or the same thing under a different name, forever.
I can't see how we're going to get out of this. I know they've been able to reduce it. I imagine that down the road, they'll find a way to get some more people home. But I don't see how they're going to be able to, if not empty the cells, then end the kind of detention that we think of as Guantanamo.
Meanwhile, whatever the debate, the facts on the ground in Guantanamo Bay tell their own story. The military is spending millions on new infrastructure around the prisons, including a cardiac care unit to accommodate an aging inmate population. It's a day to appreciate mothers. When I was a kid, going out with my white mother, she got asked, "Is he yours?" with the follow-up, "Is he adopted?" which apparently in the 70s was easier to imagine than an English woman marrying an Indian. How different are things today? On this Mother's Day, that's our cover story, our multiracial nation. This week, on a sunny, humid day in Silver Spring, Maryland, a little boy is practicing his numbers. His African-American dad, Larry Bright, holds his son's hand as the boy steps from post to post in this leafy playground just outside of Washington.
20? What kind of dice are 20?
21.
21?
Then 22.
Very good.
23? Yeah.
24?
At the top of the slide, he starts counting in his other language.
What? High. Back. One number.
South.
His mother, Ten Kim Lam, is teaching their son Vietnamese.
Slide. My husband is African American, and I'm a Vietnamese American first generation. And we have two children, and they are a perfect mix between the two of us.
Larry and Kim's son is multiracial, and he's just one of thousands born in what's been called a multiracial baby boom. 15% of marriages today are interracial and interethnic. 6 years ago, her firstborn was just 1 year old, and she was adjusting to life as a new mother.
I didn't have any friends with children, and I wanted to go out and meet other moms.
So she took her daughter to Ellsworth Park. But everyone there, moms and nannies alike, thought Kim was her daughter's nanny. The other moms wouldn't talk to her. The nannies questioned her techniques.
I mean, you're talking to, you know, this girl in Vietnamese. How does her family feel about that? Did they hire you to do that? And I said, actually, I want to teach my daughter my culture and my language as well.
It was a profound moment for her.
Never occurred to me that my motherhood would be questioned because I didn't look like my daughter.
It inspired Kim to start a blog, imnotthenanny.com. She was shocked by how many people experienced what she had. She thought it was a problem just the parents were having.
We didn't really talk about race when she was younger because I thought, well, if I don't talk about it, she'll just think everybody is equal and the same, and that wasn't the case.
That came into sharp relief when her daughter turned two. She threw a tantrum.
Yeah, I want to look like Mom. Wish I had light skin and straight hair. And I froze because I thought, what did I do wrong? Like, I never pointed any of these things out. And so that's a big lesson for me. You can't not talk about race.
Kim Lam and her husband, Larry Bright, both grew up in Louisiana, where society asked them to choose between black and white. Even for Kim, as an Asian American, there was nothing in between. But going forward, it seems their two children will have more choices.
I think they'll go as multiracial. I'm trying to set a balance in teaching them their Vietnamese culture, but then I also reiterate that they're American. That's what makes them American, is that they have this great mix of cultures.
That mix of cultures is uniquely American, and it's hard to ignore the growing trend that Kim Lam and her family are part of. Our president is a biracial man, and in media, multiracials are everywhere. And more than ever, they're touting their mixed heritage.
Jordan and I we're biracial.
Yes, half black, half white.
And Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele made their names playing black characters on the TV show Mad TV. But last year, they premiered their own show, where they take multiracial issues on with glee.
Keegan and I both have white moms.
Yes.
This is true. We have white moms. And the thing about having a white mom being a black guy is, as a kid, a white mom can't hit a black kid in public.
Can't do it. Can't do it. Gets too racial too
fast.
That's
right. It escalates to this racial thing.
But it's not often so lighthearted and funny. Beyonce turned heads when she appeared in this commercial for L'Oreal makeup.
There's a story behind my skin. It's a mosaic of all the faces before it.
On the screen, three phrases flashed: African American, Native American, French. The backlash was immediate. The singer was criticized for abandoning her black identity, but the multiracial community embraced her. It's not just that there are more multiracial and biracial people around. The government is now counting the group differently. For the first time in modern history, the 2000 census allowed us to check more than one box for race. The last census showed 9 million people, about 3% of the population, reporting more than one race. That's an increase of a third from the decade before. And it's only going up.
The youngest age group, kids under 5, 7% are identified as having more than one race group. If we look at, say, the elderly, 65 and over, it's only 1%.
That's Jeffrey Pucell, a senior demographer at the Pew Hispanic Center. More people are choosing spouses outside their own race. And as we said, about 15% of all new marriages today are interracial and interethnic. Again, Jeffrey Pucell.
That's more than double what it was in 1980 and probably five times what it was in 1960. We've reached a point where over 8% of all the people who are currently married are in mixed marriages.
Why the change? Attitudes are evolving. Over the past few decades, says Pucell, more people have simply come to view intermarriage as no big deal.
More than two-thirds of people in our surveys, when asked how they would feel about someone in their own family marrying someone of a different background, said they'd be fine with it.
Ask young people, those under 40, and those who are fine with it rises to more than 80%. But racial identity is more complicated than just checking a box. Pucell points to research that looked at kids with one black and one white parent.
When they are asked at home about their racial identification, the children tended to say that they were biracial or white and black. When they were asked at school, a much higher proportion of them identified simply as black, suggesting that it may be that their peers or their teachers or the school identified them one way, and at home they identified differently.
That's part of a long trend of multiracial people identifying as just one race. Marsha Allison Dawkins is a professor at the University of Southern California. Her father was one such multiracial man. Part black, part white.
He has lived his life as an African-American man. He lived through segregation. He lived through civil rights. And though he acknowledges these other aspects of his identity, he sees the world from the perspective of a black man. And that's how he chooses to identify.
But just one generation has made a world of difference for Dawkins herself, who is part white, black, and Latino.
My sister and I see the world a little differently. I don't think it's better or worse, but I think it's a credit to a lot of the progress that has been made both ways, that people can choose to identify just as one or choose to identify as two or more.
There are a lot more people who identify solely as one race. Do you know anything about who is doing that and why?
Yes, the census reports to us that white people are most likely to report having one race only. And one of the reasons sociologists and historians suggest for that is because of the way in which whiteness has been defined. It comes to us through law and history and custom that to be white, you actually can't be anything else.
This is the one drop rule.
Exactly. So if you're going to say you're white, operating with this mindset, then it makes sense to say you're only white. And then African Americans are next most likely to say they only have one racial background. I think that's the other side of this one drop rule, right? So you may have all of this white or other ancestry going on, but because of the one drop rule, you identify only as black. So what's been interesting for me, and this also hits home with my own personal experience, is what I call Latinos, right? So Latinos who also identify as black are more likely to identify as multiracial than people who are black and who are mixed also but don't have Latino or Latina roots. And so there's something, I think, about ways in which Latino cultures think about race and think about identity that allows for some more fluidity that is also intersecting and affecting this conversation and leads us to think about things like immigration and public policy and education in ways that are really affecting our nation at the moment.
And does this make things a lot harder for researchers?
Absolutely. At the end of the day, this is less than 3% of our nation's population. So I think we still have to keep in mind that the overwhelming majority of Americans identify as having one race only, that that's not a bad thing, but that we have to be really careful about how we read and interpret and spin these census results.
What are some of the other downsides to these racial categories becoming less stable?
Yes. Colleges are having a really tough time now managing diversity and affirmative action programs. And we're seeing this in cases that are coming up before the Supreme Court as well, that this two or more population goes to college the most, with the exception of Asian Americans. This is generally a very highly educated population. The census suggests that they also come from higher socioeconomic status backgrounds than monoracial groups. So a lot of people are fearing that traditional monoethnic or monoracial groups might be discriminated against at the expense of this new population that's coming better prepared and able to tick off all those boxes in terms of diversity, but may or may not be having the same experiences as someone who is Latino American, someone who is African American or Native American. And so just as we've seen historically that monoracial groups need to take responsibility for maybe not giving multiracials the freedom to be all of who they are all the time, multiracials also have to take some responsibility and say, hey, wait a minute, how does our entrance into this conversation disrupt, for better and for worse, resources and communities that have worked really hard to be organized?
It is difficult to talk about multiracials as a group. The issues I face as an Anglo-Indian are utterly different from what Marcia faces as a black, white, and Latina person. As she points out, for better or for worse, we only have the model of the black and white dynamic to work with. To advance the discussion, we need more than just new categories. Perhaps we need a new way to talk about race in America.
Regal Entertainment.
Randy Smith Jr. has been working for more than a decade to build a personal device for deaf people that would allow them to enjoy movies. Something that didn't require special screenings and wasn't bulky. Something that would simply put captions on the screens. And now, that device is here. They're glasses that project the captions on a screen in the form of a hologram floating about 10 feet in front of the person using them. Sort of like 3D glasses for captioning. Sony and Regal Cinemas have partnered up to create the first batch, and they'll be distributed to about 6,000 theaters across the country this month. For Randy Smith Jr., the project was also personal. His son Ryan is deaf and a self-proclaimed cinephile. Ryan was the first tester of the devices throughout the years.
It has been our goal for, you know, I'd say 15 years to develop a technology that would allow accessibility to the deaf and the blind for every showtime, for every feature. So it took us a long time, but as technologies would be developed, we'd meet with them and they would send me prototypes and I'd come home and I'd basically say, you know, Ryan, tonight we're going to go see a film and test a new technology. And he would give me feedback as to what he liked or didn't like, and we'd send that back to the technology manufacturer, and they'd tweak it.
So now that you're perfecting the technology and getting it out there, what is this going to mean for your family and the deaf community?
You know, it's hard for me to put into words. I actually got an email from a parent yesterday. If we had the time, I'd read you a couple words because I think he said it best.
If you're able to, would love to hear that.
I've attempted to enjoy a movie with my son so many times over the last 26 years, but to no avail. After watching a movie, I would try to discuss it with him. The comments he would make would in no way relate to the plot of the movie. At one point, he finally confessed that as he watched the screen, he simply made up the story in his head since he didn't really know what was going on. The fact that I can take my son to a movie when he visits at the end of June is literally bringing tears to my eyes. It would seem silly to most people, but I would imagine you understand what it feels like. And I don't think I can express it any better than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we all take for granted so much. That's pretty pretty moving.
It is, and when you have children and, you know, the forms of entertainment that we as a society engage in, movies are a big part of it. And when you completely eliminate that option for your children, or one child has to be left behind, you know, that's going to tear at your heartstring.
So you have this in 6,000 of your theaters now. How long do you think it'll take before this gets to be widespread and out there everywhere?
Regal is going to be complete at the end of this month, but most all of them will be complete by the end of this year.
Randy, congratulations again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Arun.
That was Randy Smith Jr., Chief Executive Officer for Regal Cinemas. Coming up, the hip-hop, country, metal, and soul-infused stylings of saxophonist Rudresh Mahanthappa. But first, one of America's great post-war novelists, James Salter. With the publication of his first book in 1957, he won the admiration of writers and critics alike. But after 1979, Salter's production slowed. He still wrote essays, short stories, and poetry, nearly all of it well-regarded, but nothing on a grander scale. Now he's published a new novel, and grand it is. All That Is sets out to give a sweeping account of human experience in 300 beautifully written pages. James Salter joins me now from our studios in New York. Mr. Salter, welcome to the program.
I'm very happy to be on the program.
So 34 years between novels. I mean, obviously you've written a lot of other things in the interim, but did you think you were finished with the novel? Why this interval?
No, I'd started the novel, or a novel, something like this one, and laid it down, put it aside, and then after a while, seemed to me time to pick it up again. It turned out to be not the book that I had started, but very close to it.
So there was something unusual about the gestation of this novel, All That Is?
I suppose so. The man I had originally as the hero was a more spiritual and, I guess, a less earthly person. And I just couldn't make him... I couldn't keep my interest in him up sufficiently.
Why?
I don't know. He simply failed to keep my interest. You can leave them, which is what I did.
The character you ultimately developed, who's the center of All That Is, your new novel, is Philip Bowman. He was born in 1925, raised as an only child, served in the war, which is a formative experience at the end of World War II, divorced his first wife. It sounds very much like you. Is it superficial, or does Philip Bowman have a more deeper autobiographical resonance for you?
It's suspicious, but it's also superficial. I'm really nothing like him, much more like one of several editors I know or have met that gave me an idea of what he should be like and what he should look like and where he should go and everything else.
People have talked about how you have a reverence for what they might call the masculine, and you might say this book feels written from a particularly male perspective. Do you think that's fair, and do you think maybe the female characters suffer for that?
Well, I don't know if they suffer. It is written from the male perspective. If you'd like a book from the female perspective, you might read Light Years, where Nedra is the principal figure in it, and her emotions, her character, her personality are all explicit or detailed. But Nedra is not the hero of this book. Now, you may say, but the women in it, are they treated fairly? I would say they're not treated perhaps as deeply as Bowman is.
And it's interesting how, I don't know if this is a reflection of Bowman's own state of mind from his military background, but I noticed you tend to refer to men by their last names and women by their first.
Well, you rarely refer to a woman by her last name. I mean, well, Hillary Clinton's not a good idea because they both have the name Clinton. But I mean, Kardashian, Kim Kardashian. Well, they use both names. It's hard to think of any other women on the spur of the moment here. But you always refer to a woman by her first name. But men, I think, commonly it's not so unusual to call somebody by their last name.
Near the end of the novel, and all that is, Bowman observes the power of the novel in the nation's culture, in America's culture, that is, has weakened. Do you believe that yourself?
Yes, I guess I believe it. My feelings are probably more sentimental than rational. The culture is what it is. It reforms itself. It is freshened by certain things. It is polluted by other things. And it continually revives and presents itself. So it's an unfortunate thing for a certain kind of novelist, or maybe for an older novelist. But apart from that, I don't know if it's a grave thing.
Our culture seems that we have more staying power from movies. And you had one experience with that, with your first novel, The Hunters, was turned into a movie with Robert Mitchum and Robert Wagner. It was very different from the novel. What was that like to see it transformed?
It was agony. I mean, I thought the film was a catastrophe, only because I'd written the book and I naturally could hear dialogue from the book. I knew the people in the book, what they looked like, and so forth. But in the movie, they had to make their own accommodations. Robert Mitchum was presented as a somewhat idealistic person. I mean, the idea is stupefying. I think they used the wrong airplanes and the battle scenes and all that. I didn't like the movie at all.
It sounds like, you know, a writer has to let go when something goes to the screen in that way, and it sounds like that was pretty painful for you to do.
Well, from a practical point of view, it was a godsend.
Financially?
Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to live and write for 4 or 5 years if it weren't for that. So although I regretted it on one hand, on the other, it was a very lucky thing.
You've expressed for some time a certain type of skepticism about the staying power of your work. Now you're 87 and your books are being read and embraced. Have you begun to feel that this possibility that you'll be an influence for a long time to come?
It would be vanity to answer that question. I think if you have anything that's read 20 years after your death, you've accomplished something considerable. Beyond that, it's impossible to say.
That's James Salter. His new novel is called All That Is. Mr. Salter, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, the story of a man you've probably heard of, but let's introduce him anyway.
And here is that rambling, rip-roaring, regenerating, rousing, rhythmic rajah of regnant, robust realities. Believe it or not, Bob Ripley.
Robert Ripley was a cartoonist who became an international celebrity and media superstar. His pioneering mix of the strange, the shocking, and the barely believable shaped the way Americans saw the world beyond its borders. Neil Thompson explores the man behind the character in a book called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. He joins us now. Neil Thompson, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Arun. Thanks for your interest in the book. Happy to be here.
So Robert Ripley ended up going down as one of the most well-traveled men in history, but he didn't exactly grow up in a very cosmopolitan, worldly setting. Can you talk a little bit about his childhood, his modest childhood in Santa Rosa, California?
Sure. He had a pretty difficult childhood, grew up poor in Santa Rosa, about an hour north of San Francisco. He was really an outcast growing up. He had these terrible buck teeth, disfiguring buck teeth. He was a skinny kid, a shy kid, an awkward kid. He was alone quite often, either doodling in his notebook. He was a drawer and a doodler from a very young age. But he didn't have many friends.
Do you think that led to an attraction to sort of oddball, peculiar, bizarre characters?
I really do, and I make that case in the book that as someone who was shunned and mocked as a kid, who really, and he talks about how goofy and backward he felt. He felt like this rube, this country, you know, yokel. And I think ultimately the message of his body of work is that he was someone who celebrated the underdog, championed the oddball, celebrated the weirdness of the world.
You talked about his obsessive doodling and eventually his cartooning skills, which are pretty impressive, take him to New York, where you describe a really fascinating scene in the newspaper world there in the early part of the 20th century. Can you talk about the important role that cartoonists played in that world?
Yeah, cartoons played a hugely important role in the newspaper in that era before photography was commonplace in the newspaper. He started out as a sports cartoonist. And so his job was to go to the game or the boxing match and render that event in pen and ink for the next day's paper. And some of his artwork was just fantastic. He was really a talented artist.
Let's talk about Ripley's major life-changing experience. This was his first trip around the world in 1921. What did it even mean to travel around the world in 1921?
You know, at that time, it was not common at all for people to travel extensively. But Ripley, early on in his career, was very curious about other parts of the world and very passionate about exploring those places. So he had this unique opportunity to circumnavigate the globe. And he did it in a pretty impressive way. I mean, he traveled by boat, by camelback, by donkey, by rickshaw, because he really wanted to see some of the places that he had always heard about.
Can you talk about his reaction on this trip to the city of Benares in India? This is one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities on Earth on the banks of the Ganges, and it was kind of intense for Ripley.
Yeah, I think that was a highlight. It was the first time he really experienced people doing things that were so extreme, so bizarre, he witnessed people torturing themselves, self-mutilation, these religious fanatics, fakirs, who were trying to prove their devotion to their god by staring at the sun until they went blind, by holding their arms aloft for 20 years until they became fused into place. All this extremely bizarre stuff, and he was just fascinated by it. And I think it not only changed his cartoon, the tone and look and feel of his cartoon, it changed his whole career. Within the next few years, he became this guy who presented the weirdness of the world in the daily newspaper each day. And that eventually led to a best-selling book and then another life-changing event in 1929 when William Randolph Hearst hired him for a King Features syndicate and put him on this huge global stage.
And then on top of that, he then goes on to conquer radio and then television.
He was really a multimedia pioneer, and he developed this, believe it or not, empire. Radio, TV, films, museums, lectures, he was everywhere. So, you know, by the mid-1930s, here's a guy who's making $500,000 a year. He's one of the wealthiest and best-known entertainers of his day. Eventually became sort of this Hugh Hefner-esque type character. He was just fun to be around. He was good company. Here's somebody who just loved life. He loved to throw parties. He liked to drink a lot, sometimes too much. But he's described in some of the newspaper articles of the day as always having some beautiful woman on his arm and always squiring around some pretty young thing.
Well, you know what's funny, Neil, is that this character is described in this playboy character, multimillionaire, toast of Manhattan, loves to party. But if you listen to or watch one of these broadcasts, he's not really what you might expect. I want to listen to a little bit of some of Robert Ripley on the air.
We have to commend you for your startling discoveries, Mr. Ripley.
Speaking of discoveries, did you know that Columbus never set foot on either North or South America? And his name was not Columbus. The only way he ever wrote or spelled his name was Cristobal Colón.
So in spite of his audaciousness and pioneering broadcast work, he was really painfully awkward as a speaker and presenter. But you seem to think that worked to his advantage.
I think it did. I mean, clearly from that clip, he wasn't the most dynamic of on-air performers. He would often lean on a cup of whiskey or gin before he went on the air, and it seemed to take the edge off. Early on in his career, he was very nervous on stage and on the air. He would fumble his papers. He would drop things. He would stutter. But I think people appreciated that. I think they appreciated that he was sort of one of them. He understood some of the people that he interviewed on air and had compassion for them. And I think his fans really responded to that and related to him in a unique way.
You know, I was born decades after Ripley died, but he was still such a huge figure in my childhood. I remember the museums, the books, the shrunken heads, and all that stuff. What do you think accounts for the cultural potency of Robert Ripley, even in the age of the internet, internet fact-checking, that he still has the ability to shock and fascinate?
I think what's great about his sort of staying power is that he tapped into something during his day that was there. People were hungry for what he gave them. People were curious like he was. He was the first person to really, in a mass media sort of way, titillate us and provoke us. And you see his influence, I'd argue, on today's viral videos on YouTube. You see it in some shows like The Amazing Race or Mythbusters. I think Ripley was, in a sense, the godfather of some of the reality TV shows that are part of pop culture today.
Neil Thompson is the author of A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Neil, thank you so much. This was fascinating.
Really enjoyed it, everyone. Thank you.
And it's time now for music. The LA Times recently compared this piece to the jazz fusion greats Mahavishnu Orchestra and proto-punk legends The Stooges. High praise for saxophonist Rudresh Mahanthapa, whose work defies genres. You can find the Indian American's work filed under jazz, but it's hard to find a style he doesn't touch. You'll hear touches of Western hip-hop, country, metal, and soul, fused with traditional sounds from India, Africa, and Indonesia. And he makes it rock. His latest album is called Gamak. I caught up with Mahanthapa backstage after a smoking hot show in Boston. He should have been exhausted. I was tired out from just watching him play, but he was beaming. You guys tore it up. That was a rocking set.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. We had a really great time. And we're very lucky to have already played. I mean, the album came out at the end of January, and we've already played 30 shows, I think, this year. So the band is super tight, and it's just, it's so different from the album at this point. You know, it's jumped like 6 or 7 levels.
Is there something about this type of instrumentation of this group? Because, I mean, you've had elements of rock in your music, but something about this particular group really rocks. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And that was definitely intentional. You know, I'm a child of the 80s, so I grew up with a lot of great rock. I mean, 80s rock wasn't the best, but but I still had access to 70s rock. And a lot of progressive rock stuff has been very influential. Yes, and Gentle Giant, and Rush, and Genesis. And so I wanted to bring that element to more of a forefront with this particular band. And obviously having Dave Fusinski on guitar really brings that out. Dave and I played in Jack DeJohnette's band for about 3 years. And so when it came time to do something else, we already had kind of a history and I really gave him free rein to use all the sounds he wanted and to really rock out.
I saw him quoted somewhere that with this music that he's playing now, he gets to be, it's a great phrase, a microtonal Captain Kirk.
Right, because he gets to go where no man has gone before or something like that. When I'm writing music, I'm never writing for an instrumentation. I'm writing for people. You know, I didn't sit down and write this music for guitar, bass, and drums. I wrote it for Dave Fusinski, Francois Moutin, Dan Weiss. So in saying that, what I'm doing is writing to their strengths and also writing a little bit in a fashion that will maybe push them beyond what we usually do. And I'm doing that with myself, too. I'm always writing stuff that I can't play. I have to, you know, if I write this thing and I want to play it, I have to figure out how to play it. So I'm always pushing myself as a saxophonist and as a band leader as well.
What's sort of remarkable, especially seeing you guys play, you know, a show like tonight, you talk about that kind of freedom, but it's very complexly structured music at times as well. I think, you know, rhythmically and what you're doing tonally as well.
Yeah, that's true. It is. It is very structured. You know, for the musician, you know, we talk about these odd meters. We talk about cycles, especially in Indian music. You talk about cycles of 7 beats or 13 beats or 21 beats. And those are constructs that I really relate to. And the best thing is when you feel free within those structures. And it's funny because oftentimes this music can be confused or put in like this kind of free jazz category where it's actually quite the opposite. So it's funny to me that those things end up maybe sounding the same to some people.
Well, what is it about these guys that you can make it sound, it does sound so free?
Well, I think everyone in the band developed a sort of rhythmic vocabulary. They can deal with these structures and they can internalize them very quickly. So, you know, some people think of these beat cycles, for example, these Indian talas, as being difficult. But if you find a way to internalize it, you hear it as if you're hearing blues or as if you're hearing Mary Had a Little Lamb. Or for me, everything is 90% awareness. If you're aware of the possibility to be able to do something, you'll be able to do it.
You're listening to a backstage interview with saxophonist Rudresh Mahanthappa after a recent show in Boston. Mahanthappa is an Indian name, as is mine, Roth. We're both American-born Desis, as the phrase goes. I was able to hit Rudresh with a pretty obscure reference when I pulled an old Indian CD by saxophonist Kadri Gopalnath out of my bag.
I'm going to show you something. I know you've talked about this before, but...
Oh, yeah, saxophone Indian style. You have it. This is the same copy I have.
And, well, and you can probably tell I didn't just buy that last week. I've had that for a while. It's got some weathering.
Yeah, this is a great album. This album changed my life in a lot of ways because, I mean, jazz has been institutionalized, and you can go to school for jazz. I went to school for jazz. You can learn all the theory and kind of be spoon-fed this wonderful art form. But where the real learning takes place is obviously playing with other people, but is also playing with records, you know, learning John Coltrane solos, learning Charlie Parker solos, not from a book where someone else has written them down, but really learning them by ear. If you want to learn Carnatic or Hindustani music, you go find a guru and you go study, and you might go live with this teacher for 20 years and before you're ever allowed to perform. So for me, I was trying to deal with Indian music that same way, by ear. But it was just so hard to try to emulate what the vocalists and, you know, the violinists, these string instruments, veena, sitar, whatever it was. It was so hard to emulate that on saxophone, just because of the nature of the instrument. So when I got this album, Saxophone Indian Style, I felt like I could play along with it the same way I was playing along with Coltrane records. We do this tune called Abogi that's really based on the South Indian raga, but it ends up being this boogaloo / country thing, you know, like Dave's doing this thing that sounds like a dobro or something. I mean, the way I see it, I'm trying to express what it means to be Indian American. So I'm not interested in doing anything that's overtly Indian because I don't feel overtly Indian. I mean, I feel Indian and American and neither and both all at the same time, every second of every day. And I feel like the music should reflect that too.
You were born in Italy, right?
I was born in Italy. My dad was on sabbatical. That's why I was born in Italy.
But are you familiar with the phrase ABCD?
Oh, yeah. American born confused Desi?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. A cab driver in Chicago turned me on to ABCD, and he was actually referring to me in a very derogatory sort of way. I was like, what does that mean? And then he told me, I was like, I think I'll get out of your cab now. You know?
But there's something about, you know, I was thinking about your music and these wild range of influences. That it's similar to what I had growing up in America, but at the same time, it doesn't feel confused.
It swings.
Well, I think the interesting thing is embracing the confusion. If you own the confusion, then you won.
Rudresh Mahanthappa. We spoke after a recent concert in Boston. He's playing later this week in New York City, and his new album is called Gamak. If you want to hear some tracks from the album, and trust me, you do, go to nprmusic.org. For the week ending May 12th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Amy Hell, Lily Percy, Liz Baker, Connor Donovan, Acacia Squires, and Becky Sullivan. Our intern is Rachel Rude. The technical directors are Stu Rushfield and Peter Olima. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. You can find us on Twitter at NPRWATC. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.